Well, up next, we're going to talk Dead Wrong with Richard Belzer, comedian and actor. You've probably have seen him in Law and Order, the one called Special Victims Unit. He's been on it for a long, long time. We're going to talk with him about incredible conspiracies on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Belzer, of course, stand-up comedian, actor, author. Currently, of course, you know him as John Munch on the NBC show Law and Order: Special Victims Unit. And he's written a number of books, UFOs, JFK, Elvis novels, and he's also been a radio host himself. His latest work is Dead Wrong. And you know what? I can honestly say Richard Belzer is a friend of mine. Welcome, Richard. How are you?
Well, my friend, at last we are on the air together.
Absolutely. I mean, are things going well for you, your family?
Oh, yes, my kids and wife and dogs are doing great. They're all thrilled I'm on the show.
That is so cool. You know, so many people have had their lives influenced by you. My friend Dennis Miller, who does his own shows, thinks the world of you. I mean, you're responsible for his direction.
Well, he was my opening act, you know, many years ago. he's been very gracious in, you know, saying I was an influence on him.
Richard,
not politically, stylistically.
Exactly. And he's changed politically. As I want to get into soon, Dead Wrong, this incredible book that you wrote with David Wayne, but today Phyllis Diller died, 95 years old. Did you know her at all?
Yeah, she was a friend and one of the most supportive and sweetest. I mean, every comedian, Richard Lewis and I, and every comedian, whoever crossed her path, just adored her. She was hip. She was like a great, you know, with all due respect, an old broad, had been through it all. And, you know, Bob Hope helped her a lot in the beginning.
Yeah.
But she certainly had her own brilliant timing, and she was a great joke writer. And just everyone who ever met her, I mean, it's not a cliche, you know, the show business is full of all different kinds of people, but she was as close as you get to as a, you know, a really perfect, gracious, supportive, loved other comedians, loved to laugh.
Well, that cackle that she had, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, going to dinner at her house was, you know, an event, or just hanging out with her. You know, one time I had a job in Florida and she was my opening act, and I felt like, wait a minute, shouldn't I be? But she was so gracious and wonderful.
Well, when I heard today, Richard, she had died at 95, I went, my God, I didn't know she was 95.
Yeah, no, she, you know, Bob Hope is 102.
That's right.
Well, part of the reason I'm a comedian is longevity, George.
That's right. Exactly. Well, you know what?
A long time.
Happy people live longer, Richard.
Well,
they do.
If you reflexively find humor, it's been proven medically that that's a stress reliever and a pain reliever and all kinds of studies. But you have a great sense of humor. You know that.
I do. I sure do. Well, let's get in. Well, anyways, Phyllis Diller gone, 95 years old. She will be missed.
Absolutely. And we just lost my friend Marvin Hamlisch in the week before Gore Vidal.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, the three huge American icons that are
in a director, Tony Scott, jumped off a bridge in L.A.
Oh, God, that is so heartbreaking.
Did you hear about that? Yeah.
He had inoperable cancer.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's so sad. Anyways, tell me about this. You know, when you and I got together for lunch, we talked about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But your fascination with many of our subjects, we parallel each other so much.
Yeah, I know.
And this book, Dead Wrong, is dead on.
Thank you.
You know,
well, the reason I'm so proud of this, George, is because it's going to be in the history section. And my other books have been, you know, entertainment or comedy or
that's right.
Whatever. You know, I've written two novels. I've written two nonfiction books. But David Wayne is an amazing scholar. I mean, he's been studying this material for almost 30 years. He's a microanalyst of media, how the media covers these events. So his research is impeccable. And, you know, because I'm an actor and a comedian, when I address some of these serious subjects, and, you know, you and I have talked, you know how serious I am. I'm not...
In person, you do not seem like you're a comedian. I mean, you're darn serious about stuff.
Well, yeah, on certain subjects, certainly.
Yeah.
But, you know, people can easily marginalize or roll their eyes at me, but not with this book. I've done many, I've had a lot of, you know, local radio interviews, and this is my first big national one. Thank you so much.
And Jesse Ventura, our friend, wrote the afterword.
Yeah,
the afterword is after the foreword is the afterword.
Exactly.
And that's what he wrote. He's I like him.
Yeah, well, Jesse is one of those Americans who, you know, loves his country and is disappointed in the system and, you know, some of the people that are running things. It's not, you know, people accuse me of, you know, oh, you hate America. No, I don't hate America. I'm disappointed. I love this country. And I think the reason I'm so excited about the book is because, pardon the expression, it is bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is backed up. The footnotes are astounding. The research that he's done and what little research I've done in combination. Another thing that was amazing, George, was the gods are smiling on us. When we first started talking and emailing, our writing style is incredibly similar, which is really, you know, moved this along after all the years of research. So as you can see by the style of it, it's because I used to be a newspaper reporter. He's a historian. And, you know, it's like Sherlock Holmes said, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. You know, and that's what we wanted to do, and I think we've accomplished it. The reviews have been outstanding, and no one has refuted anything that we've asserted, because, you know, it's like a FBI agent we interviewed said, I have no theories, I just have facts.
Absolutely. And, you know, I loved all the chapters, specifically the Kennedy one, because I knew Jimmy Hoffa. I was 25 years old when he disappeared, and I may have been, and I've said this on the show a number of times, mm-hmm. the last news person to talk to him.
Really?
I walked him to his car, and he was gone a few weeks later.
Whoa.
And I didn't ask him the one question that you've highlighted in your book was his involvement with JFK's murder and assassination. I didn't want to ask him then because I thought he'd bump me off or something.
Well, yeah, you know, you were wise not to ask him. I mean, he wanted to bomb Bobby Kennedy's house at one point. We have recordings of, and one of his cohorts. So what if his kids are in there? I mean, anyway, you know, the thing that's amazing to me is that what I've always been fascinated by is things that are true that aren't generally known, and the way people accept it or reject it, even though it's true. And you run up against that all the time, I'm
That's
sure.
Right.
Where here it is, the facts, and people just, certain people, and I'm not talking about people that are ignorant, just people that can't wrap their head around the government actually, you know, murdering someone and then covering it up. Not necessarily the government as an institution, but elements within the government.
That's right.
Occasionally go rogue, and then the whole government, out of institutional embarrassment, has to cover it up. So the cover-up seems bigger than the crime, and it gets all complicated, and the details get obfuscated. So.
And it truly gets ugly, doesn't it?
Well, it's sad, but, you know, time and time again, you know, and we're talking about famous people. It doesn't matter who you are. If you're in the way, you're in the way. And, you know, like Marilyn Monroe was clearly murdered. Most people think, oh, she committed suicide. Nothing could be further from the truth.
She was in the way. I mean, I've always said, Richard, no coincidences.
You know? I think that my feeling is she was murdered to embarrass the Kennedys, say the president's mistress commits suicide, but they didn't count on the people coming there and not calling the police for 6 hours and cleaning up the scene for other reasons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, really, the original intent was not met, but poor Marilyn, you know, she was on the phone talking to a friend. She said, I think I heard something, never came back to the phone. You know, and they found the window broken from the inside. They said she took these, you know, Nembutal, but when you take a lot of pills, you die before they're all digested. There's nothing in her stomach. They said she drank water. Her bathroom sink was broken. I mean, just on and on. The first police officer on the scene, George, walked in and said, staged suicide. I mean, she was ramrod straight in her bed. It was everything was cleaned up. It was just too neat.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, 100 1,000 other things that point to murder.
That picture I've seen of her dead is unbelievably horrible.
Well, it's ghoulish that it got released.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking.
It doesn't even look like her.
No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And God knows, she was, there were bruises on her, so she was kind of manhandled, probably knocked out, and then
yes.
given a lethal enema.
That's right. Exactly. Well, when you wrote the book, Dead Wrong, what did you want the world to know?
Well, like I said before, previously, for years I've been, since John Kennedy's assassination and then my reawakening with Watergate, when a lot of the same names started popping up, they're involved in Watergate, they're involved with Bay of Pigs, and it's like, wait a minute, I really got fascinated by the permanent national security state. And, I learned that presidents are part-time workers, and since, Truman signed the National Security Act in 1947, we've had this kind of government within a government. As Bill Moyers has done brilliant work on it. This is all documented stuff. And I've always been fascinated by, and now, actually, more and more, I'm distressed by the contempt that the so-called elites or the government or whoever, the bankers and certain elements within the government have for the people. They just come out and out and say things like, if we there is no voter fraud in Pennsylvania, but if we suppress enough votes, Romney will get in. I mean, they just like to say it on camera. And other, and banks are sitting on trillions and, so I'm outraged because an informed citizenry is what was intended by, the Jeffersonian idea of democracy. And I just want people to be on guard, to be armed with knowledge, to know how to talk to the spineless Congress, to really guide them to their own self-interest. And this book is really, it's serious, but it's like the best 10 murder mysteries, and there's things in here that aren't known, that are literally unbelievable. Like, for instance, in 1999, a jury in Tennessee found that the United States government was involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. I mean, that was a jury trial. That's not generally known. And Lyndon Johnson having people murdered, things that are common knowledge in Texas, leaked out, and now we have all this testimony. And
the King family never believed that James Earl Ray killed him.
No, and he pleaded guilty because he didn't want to be electrocuted.
Yeah.
And for him to do, first of all, the famous photo of the guy, of the people pointing up at the shooter on the balcony at the Lorraine Hotel.
Yeah, with Jesse Jackson's there.
Yeah, all those people.
Reverend Abernathy.
They were pointing up. And James Earl Ray was straight across from the balcony. There was a bathtub next to the window where he would have to contort himself to do the shot, and his rifle didn't match the bullet that killed Dr. King. He mysteriously had money and getaway cars and, could go to Europe. And the King family believed him that he was innocent.
That's right.
From day one.
How did you get the subject matter for the book? I mean, you start with Frank Olson. We'll talk about him in a moment.
Sure.
How did you get these cases? I mean, well, obviously Monroe and JFK, that's obvious. But what about these others?
Well, these are cases that David Wayne, I must say, has done much more research on than I have. And just this compelling information. I mean, I knew about Frank Olson and I knew about Henry Marshall and George Kritelik, but thank God for David Wayne being, the scholar that he is, filling in all these amazing holes with, forensic and scientific evidence, and it's just all irrefutable. That's why I'm so, gleeful about it. And
Olson was the CIA guy who was drugged, wasn't he?
Well, Frank Olson was in 1953. Actually, he was involved in the Project Artichoke and all the dark interrogation stuff that was going on after World War II, and it became quite repelled by the technique, and the irony is they did to him what he was repelled by. They gave him LSD without him knowing it, and you know, they murdered him. And then it took his family years to get a re-exhumation of his body and prove that he was in fact murdered. And they had to settle, you know, they settled with the family. Finally, it was a big embarrassment to the government. It was finally settled during the Ford administration. This happened in 1953.
Jeez.
And George, guess who were the two guys that handled this for the Ford administration?
Oh, don't tell me.
Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were ordered to, or were in charge of keeping the family quiet, trying to buy them off. That's where the term, you know, limited hangout from the Watergate days comes from, or was used, employed. So it's, to me, it's, you just keep seeing the same people popping up over and over again. And it gets,
yeah, in every different thing, where yeah, they are.
Yeah, and for years, it's like, you know, the Iraq study group, long before there was a 9/11 or anything, you know, these people were, and, you know, wanted to go into Iraq for what, you know, whatever reason.
Let's get into Marilyn Monroe again, Richard.
Okay.
I mean, you've got two pictures of her, such a juxtaposition of the very gorgeous Marilyn Monroe.
Yes.
And then, I'm telling you, I'd lose money on a bet on that photograph.
Unrecognizable.
There.
Oh. And, you know, it's heartbreaking because the last thing on her mind was suicide. She had a hair appointment the next day. She had projects she was involved in. I mean, she was a lot smarter and sharper than most people think. She had, I don't believe she had any intention of embarrassing the Kennedys or calling a news conference, all these rumors that were floated.
Yeah. I mean, is that even her, that picture we're seeing? I mean, the one
well,
they sent out?
I never thought of it, but it's a good question.
Maybe they carted her off somewhere, and, you know, she's been taken away.
Unfortunately, no, Marilyn was murdered. It's, you know, it's the first, our book is really the first to prove that Marilyn Monroe was murdered.
Right.
Not with theories or suppositions, but with scientific and forensic facts.
I've just never seen the face of a body that has changed so much. I mean, she went through a metamorphosis. I mean,
when
people die relatively soon without tragic accident, they still look the same. I mean, this is bizarre.
You know, they didn't call the police for 6 hours. And I don't know, you know, it's, who knows what. And, you know, she was manhandled and knocked out, and then...
I mean, she's puffy. She looks like she's got a double chin. You know, it's bizarre.
It's sad. But, you know, the scientific evidence is overwhelming. It's literally impossible that she swallowed the pills they say that killed her, because there was absolutely no refractive crystals in her digestive system. And if the drugs were swallowed, then there would have to be crystals.
She was killed to embarrass the Kennedys.
That's my feeling.
And then maybe someone else got there to clean it up.
No, the people got there. They called the studio PR. Her psychiatrist, Dr. Greenson, came. Another doctor came. Her housekeeper was cleaning stuff up. Peter Lawford came. I mean, they, for 6 hours, were cleaning that place up. So whoever murdered her, their intentions, you know, they didn't count on that. They thought that, you know, there'd be a call, and the ambulance would come, and, you know, the president's girlfriend killed herself, and we can embarrass Jack Kennedy. But it didn't happen.
All right, stay with us, Richard. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back in a moment with Richard Belzer, Dead Wrong. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our special guest, Richard Belzer, here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, by the way, make sure you're part of our program tomorrow if you are a Coast Insider, because you get to participate in chats, and we've got a guest chat tomorrow, of course, with our very special guest, Joshua P. Warren, of course, will be chatting on Tuesday, so take advantage of it. You can become a Coast Insider for less than 15 cents a day. We're going to be back in a moment, continue talking with Richard Belzer about his work, Dead Wrong, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Richard Belzer with us. Richard, with stories like Marilyn Monroe.
George, may I just put a little button on that?
Yeah.
We also established that Bobby Kennedy visited Marilyn at her home on her last day. And there are verified witnesses that, you know.
He borrowed a car for somebody.
Somebody pulled, you know, police officer pulled them over and saw him in the car and a few other people. And he was there that day. But that was apparently the catalyst, you know, for Marilyn's murder, to implicate Bobby Kennedy in her murder and ruin him politically. So it was also the reason for the cover-up. You know what I mean? It was, which we also document very clearly. That's why her murder was turned into a suicide, to preclude a murder investigation, which would, by necessity, involve the Attorney General of the United States. You know what I mean, Bobby Kennedy?
So they had to clean up
what was going on during the missing 6 hours between the time the body was discovered and the time that the police were finally called.
They had to clean up the murder in order to save them, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they had an interest in protecting the Kennedys for other reasons. You know, Kennedys didn't kill her, but it would have looked bad, you know, if he was there that day.
That's
and
right.
She killed herself.
And then she dies, yeah. Unbelievable.
But it backfired and got messy, but they got away with it because the official finding was she died on August 5th, and it was suicide, but she died on August 4th.
Well, why was there really no investigation afterward?
Well, there was a perfunctory one that's, you know, that we show was, you know, very fishy, obviously, and then we prove scientifically and forensically that she was murdered. And, well, the institutional embarrassment, and, you know, he was the Attorney General of the United States, and there really was, the evidence really was cleaned up. The first police officer on the scene said it was a staged event, you know.
Right.
He's on.
He could tell, and he's got experience.
Yeah, and all the police that came there were, you know, said, what's going on? You know, the window's broken from the inside to make it look like someone broke in, and it was just strange.
Playing the part of John Munch, the detective, does that help you in this book with the work you did?
Well, I was interested in this stuff before I became John Munch, but there's certainly, over the years, my character has been called a conspiracy theorist and, you know, dissident cop. You know, where one leaves off and the other begins is uncertain.
You've done like 290 episodes or something.
Well, we do our 300th episode starting this year.
And you've been there since the get-go, haven't you?
I've been there since day one. And actually, George, this year I will tie James Arness as the longest-running character in primetime.
That's fantastic.
He was Matt Dillon for 20 years. I'll be Munch for 20 years.
What kind of a life do you think is left in the show?
Well, we have two new, great new actors who came on last season, and the scripts have always been good, but they're kind of edgier this year. We have great guest stars, so, I mean, there's no way of knowing. I think it has kind of new life, so we'll see.
And NBC seems happy with it.
Well, you know, we're their number one drama. It's the most DVR'd show, and, you know,
that's great.
All the signs are good, and plus it's like in over 100 countries around the
Super.
World.
Have you always lived in New York?
I was born in Connecticut.
Okay.
But as soon as I could, I put on my shades and came to New York and went to jazz clubs.
You've been an East Coast person for a long time.
Yeah. I moved to L.A. in 1981 when I met my beautiful wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's funny, I moved to L.A. and then I got a job in New York hosting a talk show.
And back you went.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, no, I'm a bicoastal, but as you know, I also live in France part of the year.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely. What do they think of us over there, Richard?
Well, I live in the French countryside in a little village that hid Jews during the war, and a lot of resistance fighters are from that area. They're very warm, hardy people. Most of them are farmers, and but generally, I think all of Europe looks at us, particularly this presidential campaign, like, you know, it's like a clown show, even to them. Not that they have the greatest politics in the world, but it's kind of embarrassing what's going on in this country with the contentiousness and the adolescent kind of name-calling. And
they expect more from us, and they're not getting
it. Well, you know, they admire us.
Yeah.
You know, there was a while there where they wanted to be us, you know, and, you know, between Kennedy and Clinton and everything in between. I mean, you know, but then when Bush's two terms really they, you know, people say, how could you reelect the guy? And I had to reassure them, first of all, I didn't vote for him. And second of all, he may have stolen, probably stole the election. And they said, oh, okay. Because, you know, once was crazy enough, but when he was reelected, they were, my friends in Europe were like flabbergasted.
Those are interesting times, weren't they?
Well, that's an Arab curse, isn't it, George?
Yeah.
But no, I think that it's a time, it's one of the starkest choices we've ever had in a presidential election. And, you know, people ask me, you know, who I'm going to vote for and what, you know, what my, the way I vote is, I mean, I have problems with Obama, but obviously I have bigger problems with Romney.
Right.
When I vote, I take into consideration, will there be less suffering in the world with this person in office?
Right. Or are we better than we were 4 years ago?
Yeah. And that's exactly right. So it's a question of humanity and decency. And then, you know, if, when Obama's reelected, he won't have to run for reelection, so he can, you know, really use the bully pulpit and pocket vetoes and recess appointments and do this speech on gun control that he did on race. Not take people's guns away, just prevent, you know, the large clip capacity and have better background checks. And, you know, we can't take guns away. I wouldn't want that, but we want more responsible use of guns.
And, well, it's going to be an interesting future for all of us, Richard. You know?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that there's also a spiritual awakening in America, too, that's finally bubbling up also.
You can feel that.
I can feel it. Also, I think smart is coming back. You know, there, unfortunately, during the 8 years of Bush, they kind of demonized education, which is a bizarre thing in a country that, you know, prides itself on our, you know, our scientists, scholars, everything.
Do you do much comedy anymore?
Yeah, I'm going to be performing November 24th at the Triad Theater in New York City.
Do you write your own material, or do you have writers?
I do. I have some help with the music, but I do write my material.
How did you start?
Well, I started as an actor, not a stand-up. I went the other way.
Okay.
Expression. I went actually on a dare in 1971. There was an ad in the Village Voice for improv players to do this. There was an underground television show called Groove Tube, which was on three monitors in a little 90-seat theater.
Okay.
Before cable. You know, this is like 1970.
Yeah.
71. And they were doing stuff, you know, movie parodies, commercial parodies, news parodies. In fact, it's what Lorne Michaels based Saturday Night Live on. So I auditioned for that first, and then while doing that, I kind of got the courage to do stand-up. So I started doing stand-up, and the rest is history.
Were you always funny? As a kid?
I was thrown out of every school I ever went to.
You were?
Oh, yeah. Uncontrollable wit. You know, I actually, it's funny, I just had my 50th class reunion, George. 5-0.
That is something.
And some of my classmates who I haven't seen in 50 years brought the yearbook over, and I assigned some of them Jerry Lewis.
That's funny.
No, I was class clown and thrown out, and people reminded me of all these great stories. I brought a documentary crew with me, so it was very moving. I was going there with kind of a...
Did you remember them?
Well, I remembered virtually every one, particularly girls. That one girl said, you know, Richard Belzer had an ongoing battle with my girdle, and my girdle always won. You know, it was great.
It is amazing, though, how people change after 50 years, and our minds remember them the last time we saw them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you see the yearbook picture, and then the person, like,
yeah.
One of my classmates said, you know, every time you're on TV, my grandkids go, Grandpa, there's your friend. I said, please don't say Grandpa.
Yeah, exactly. What is sad, how many people that we went to school with who have died?
Well, I'm 68.
Yeah.
So... yeah, we lost
but,
a few.
But some of them, Richard, died really early after you graduated.
Well, Vietnam.
Yeah.
I lost some friends in Vietnam, and some friends I lost to crime, because I grew up in a poor neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that's tough.
And went on up, you know, it was an American dream. We started in a poor neighborhood, and then my father did a little bit better, and we finally got like a little ranch house. But, yeah, I mean, you know, when you live a long time, life presents itself. You can't predict what's going to happen.
No,
not at all. We're all mortal, and we're all in this together.
Richard, let me ask you about conspiracies,
sure,
which is, of course, the body of Dead Wrong.
Not really. It's a history book. That's why I'm so proud of it.
What is it about people not believing things? I mean, anything that happens, they say there's a conspiracy behind it. I mean, the horrible shooting in Aurora, Colorado,
mm-hmm,
done by a sick individual.
Right.
As soon as it was done, people said he was manipulated by government to go in and kill everyone.
Well, that's, you know,
what is it about people that where they just don't believe anybody anymore?
Well, that's the sad reality, is that because the government and the press have obfuscated and lied and misinformed for so long,
you don't know what to believe.
People on, you know, the average American, you know, and I don't blame them, you know, they're really, you know, they, like you and I, we read a lot and we do research,
mm-hmm,
but most people, you know, they're worried about their jobs and their mortgage and their kids, and, you know, I don't blame people for not having the knowledge, but people who don't have knowledge can be easily manipulated.
Sure.
And made to fear things that aren't as fearful as, you know, upon further examination, you know, they should be. And, you know, it can really be traced back to the beginning of public relations, you know, 100 years ago, when the Rockefellers, this is a fascinating story, because in 1940, you ever hear of the Ludlow Mine Massacre? There were these miners on strike in Ludlow, Indiana, I believe, and it was a very successful strike. It lasted quite a while. And then it became a tent city, and the miners brought their wives and mothers and kids, and it was like 7-8 months, and all they were striking for was for the mining company to adhere to the state mining laws. They just wanted a decent wage and safety. It wasn't like, you know, crazy.
Right. It was in Colorado.
That's right, Ludlow, Colorado. And then they celebrated Easter 1914. The next day, the National Guard came in and torched the place and shot it up, and 11 women and children were killed, and it was a disaster. And the mine was owned by the Rockefellers, and the Rockefellers also happened to pay the National Guard at that time.
Oh, my God.
And this was what we call, in today's parlance, a public relations disaster. So the Rockefellers, who had limitless funds, hired a public relations person to change their image. And this guy recommended that they, build some hospitals, build some schools. The old man should be seen in public giving out money. Junior should be photographed at work sites, because they were crushing labor and killing miners. They had to change their image. And that was really the dawn of it. The guy who worked for them invented the press release. Up until 1914, press releases were churches or schools. They would say, you know, there's a picnic Thursday, and the reporters would, but he like would lie in them, and the press wasn't sophisticated enough to pick it out. He would ghost write letters to the president and create false stories to justify what was going on. And that was 100 years ago. And today there are more PR people than there are journalists. So the government and the corporations, I know, you know, people resist this information, but they do control us. In
I
could ever imagine.
I don't blame people for not believing.
Yeah. And the scary part is that, you know, where people do get information, like, for instance, recently, you know, for years there are these legitimate objective studies of Fox News and news in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the most recent one was they polled people who don't watch any news at all, and they polled Fox News viewers. The people who don't watch any news at all were more informed, better informed than people who watch Fox News. And that's like, you know, a university study.
Yeah.
And that's chilling, because, you know, Fox News is the arm of the right. There's no qualms about it. And, you know, if the left had a similar thing, Obama would have won by 90 million votes. There'd be, you know, 70 Democratic senators. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like,
it just shows you how when you control the...
It's powerful.
You control the message.
Well, Marshall McLuhan once said, the media is the message.
Exactly.
And he was right.
He was right. It's a global village. But, you know, also, George, you know, when they say it's 1984, but I think 1984 goes both ways now.
Yeah.
With the web, we can look back a little bit, and that's kind of maybe putting a chill on the government.
Richard, what would you say is the most shocking revelation in Dead Wrong as
well,
a history book?
What I didn't know that my partner found out, David Wayne, that in 1999, a jury found the government was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. That's a jury trial in Tennessee in 1999.
Yeah.
That was revelatory.
That was swept under the carpet.
Yeah, and there's information in there about Vince Foster, a picture I'd never seen of the scene of where his body was, and a photo, color photograph of the weapon in his hand, which was a Black 32 in the photo, but in the official decision, the findings were he killed himself with a silver antique pistol. And there's a photograph of him with a black gun in his hand. I mean, it's that blatant.
Yeah. How do you get that wrong?
It's just that blatant. His car wasn't there when they first found him. He had carpet fibers on him. I mean, I don't know who murdered him, but clearly his body was moved. He had a defensive wound on his hand from the shot. You know, also James Kelly, the English scientist genius, who knew Blair was lying about Iraq.
Right. Oh, they said he slit his wrists by a tree.
Well, he said to several people, if we go to war in Iraq, you'll probably find me dead in the woods.
Yeah.
And they found him dead in the woods.
They said he cut his wrists, yet there was no blood around him.
Yeah, and when his body was moved, and it was a kind of, there's a classic way of killing people where you go to shake their hand and you cut them from, you cut their wrist.
Instantly.
But you cut it towards you, the murderer.
You pull it towards
you. And that's
him.
The kind of wound he had. But anyway, you know, clearly he didn't kill himself.
All right, stay with us, Rich. We're going to hit this break.
Sure.
Come back. Final hour with you. We're going to open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Richard Belzer about his life as a comedian or, of course, with the NBC show Law & Order and also his book, Dead Wrong. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.